same time, in terms of popular notions of who, who's Protestant, what it means to be Protestant, I think there's two stereotypes, and there's kind of the Uncle Andy stereotype of the ultra loyalist, and then there's the religious one of somebody who's a committed Protestant, committed to the Westminster Confession, and so on. So there's political Protestant, and there's a religious Protestant, and sometimes there's an overlap. Clearly, our last First Minister could tick those boxes in both senses, in both religious Protestant and political Protestant in that sense. So those are the kind of stereotypes on the continuum, the closer you are to the Uncle Andy or the Reconstructive Evangelical, the more Protestant you are, if you like. But at the same time, if you are Protestant, you know there's a much bigger, wider, more interesting range of identities. I suppose it's just by way of illustration, this is something I never knew myself, but the Girls' Brigade was first formed in Dublin. And you know, it was this worldwide, if you like, reference in terms of both the Protestant and more particularly Presbyterian identity actually is an Irish phenomenon. And it's really striking to me that there's so many different notions of Protestant within those broader categories. And I suppose more particularly, the one that I want to speak to is, as it says in the description of the talk, a dissenting tradition. And I suppose just to, again, put that in context, I should throw in a wee bit of personal biography. My own, in terms of my own, I don't know if coming out is the right word, but my own sense of journey towards being politically conscious of being an Irish Protestant, the key event in my life was probably the going to London. It was actually leaving Ireland or leaving the North, going to live in London and becoming comfortably Irish for the first time, and being, first of all, forced to confront my Irishness because I was been told I was Irish all the time. But also been quite happy and comfortable in that place. So I was thinking about that personal journey just in terms of how I got there myself, just in preparation for the essay. And I think it wasn't that we didn't all tell the difference in terms of Northern Protestants living in, or sorry, Northerners living in London. It wasn't that I stopped being a Protestant in that sense, but certainly to most English people, they couldn't tell the difference. They could start with the Irish and I in terms of that. And more particularly, I think it's the case where the huge numbers of Southern Irish people living in London that time didn't really tell the difference either. I was just a Northerner, I was a Protestant or Catholic. So both of those other aims of me, if you like, were particularly significant in terms of me having to come to terms with my own identity. That begins to explain what forced me to address some of these questions. And I suppose the other thing I wanted to do, just in terms of preparation for the discussion, is that for me it's very important to distinguish that politics of identity from other forms. I suppose the obvious example of this is whiteness. Sort of been doing a wee bit of unrelated work on ethnicity in the North. And it is quite shocking when I look at the census return and they construct 98.2% of this population still is white. It's like, I'm actually going to say everybody in this room is constructed as their ethnic identity is white. And that, you know, that's true, and I think it's important that it's recorded, and it's kind of both interesting and shocking that there's no more construction of what whiteness means or should mean in the North of Ireland. But it's also not an identity that I personally would want to particularly claim. I'm happy for it to be recorded. I think it's important in terms of equality of warning. But whiteness isn't something that I want to embrace positively. It's just that it's something that sits there. So I'm contrasting that particular form of identity with Protestantness, which in some ways might seem just as problematic, just as reactionary in some ways, in some contexts, as notions of whiteness. But for me, Protestant is a term structure just to work through the what I want to say. And I suppose this is probably the teacher in me coming out, but there's three key texts which I think help us in this journey. I'll just reference them briefly because they help me address what I want to say. The first is Glenn Campbell's The Standing Voice, which is really a history of what he calls Protestant democracy. And I suppose there's many reasons why that's an important text. Side of that is, of course, that it wasn't me as an individual who was wonderful, it was just I was part of the tradition, and that's exactly what Dan Campbell's book about, this notion of Protestant democracy, is about. It's about recognizing that there are and have been lots of Protestants who have been part of liberation movements, progressive movements, the labor movement, the trade union movement, and so on. So the notion that to be Protestant is somehow to be put in the elevator in the of politics is just simply wrong. There's a tradition there which, if you choose to reclaim it, is just as much yours as a Protestant as the kind of stereotype ones they talked about before, the ultra-Loyalist or the ultra-Loyalist. So that's one text which I would speak to about in terms of history. The second is Susan McKay's Northern Protestants and Unsettled People. Probably the key text, a text which I can't, with very brutal honesty, addresses the malaise, that notion of the unsettledness of contemporary Protestant identity, and one that, as I say, is brutal and shining a light. But if people are wanting to engage critically with what it means to be Protestant, you read that book and you go, yes, we have, as Protestants, we have problems. There's things that we need to address that we can't get away with, that we can't avoid addressing and ourselves to transcend. And then the final text is Marilyn Hyland's Further Afield, which, again, quite a lot of us are getting on the room, both places I see. And those of you who are over 40 from the left, and it's what was important about it was an attempt to do what I'm doing here today. It's from very different perspectives, people from a Protestant background offering an analysis of how they got to a position where they had different forms of transformative or progressive politics. And it's a wee bit out of date now, which is supposed by where there's a justification for this. Lecture. It's also still an important text, and again, just reflecting on it in terms of what I wanted to say today, there's two key things here that stood out of it. First is that a third of the people in that book are writing honestly, it's just really shocking. That is a wee bit like the context challenge in terms of how it's been made. A third of the people writing that book just before the ceasefire, it was at a time when we were moving towards peace, but still a third of the people in that room couldn't identify who they were. Now, for some of it was because there was an immediate danger, I think, in the sense that if they were Republican activists in the Denver, that they might have immediate threat in terms of their lives. But I think for most of the people, my sense would be that it was much more about there's a terrible cost sometimes for bucking the trend, for challenging, for speaking as a Protestant who's not prepared to put up with some of the stuff that's detailed in Susan McKay's book. Just a few years ago, I remember having this conversation with a Protestant, one of the fairly senior members of Sinn Féin. The point where he joined and went public, his mother stopped speaking to him, she hadn't spoken to him again. I mean, it's a kind of psychic cost for people. So the third of people who didn't identify themselves in the book, I think there's a reason for it. It's part of explaining why basic discussions are important, but also it continues to remind us just how difficult it is for some people, and that does need to be recognized. So there you have a basic structure for what I want to say now: the past, the present, the past Brown Campbell, the present Susan Mackay, and the future Marilyn, whatever else I can come up with today. And in terms of the past, obviously I'm going to have to be fairly selective in terms of what I identify in the course of 4 years, but I suppose the core bit of what I want to say is that it's not just about ideas. A lot of the stuff that I end up suggesting is that it is possible to reinvent yourself, it is possible to find the ideas that can put us somewhere different in terms of the politics of the North and the politics of Ireland. But at the same time, the structural context in which people find themselves was a key element in forging the identities that they developed. So anyway, the past, I think the first thing that makes us Protestants in Ireland is colonisation itself. And that lays down a very deep and lasting sense of both who we are and more particularly our relationship to Catholics or indigenous people in Ireland. And that, you know, that never goes away, that sense of being unsettled, I think, is rooted first in that initial coming to the island. And the only thing I would say with regard to encouraging discussion on that is the bit of that always kind of surprises me, and in some ways even more striking to me now that I live in Scotland, is that there's hardly any analysis or questioning of why we came. You know, what is it that made people want to come here and place themselves in an inevitably problematic relationship to the people who were here already, the Indigenous Catholics or Irish. That there's an interesting question, like, well, what was that journey about? What was it drove us here? Why did we want to leave? You know, you hardly ever hear that addressed or discussed. So anyway, despite the legacy of that history, within 200 years, in the 1790s, symbolised by this fantastic building that we're in, you have, you know, an international enlightenment associated with the French Revolution, but you have a local variant of it, both Presbyterian and Protestant, particularly Northern, which finds expression through the United Irish Movement in political terms, but it's about much more. It's a much broader enlightenment project, which has a whole range of different consequences, including, as we saw, this beautiful building that we're in and the little colleges that surround it. So it's a really significant progressive historical change. But in Ireland, it takes quite, I think, in some ways, a quite amazing form, in the sense that a group of people who were defined as colonists 200 or 300 years before can come up with a politics which is as progressive as it gets, even today. I mean, but certainly in 1798 or 1795 to 98 period, you've got a group of particularly Protestants and particularly Presbyterians within that coming up with notions of Irishness which are still radical, still inclusive, still anti-sectarian in the most remarkable way. I mean, clearly it draws on the French Revolution and also on the American Revolution, but what's for me still almost magical about that is that this group of Protestant intellectuals can envisage a notion of Ireland which includes Indigenous people, includes Catholics, in a way that most of the Enlightenment intellectuals in the States couldn't do in terms of enslaved people, couldn't do in terms of Native Americans. So it's a really remarkable, radical envisioning of the kind. heavy that that you should have done that we're capable of constructing in Ireland. And it's also one that addresses sectarian tensions, and one that speaks to the need to find ways of marking that, of recognising that we're coming from Protestants and Catholics and dissenters. It's not one that just kind of wishes them away. It's one that says that the real, that there's ways of creating constitutions, of creating a politics which can transcend that in a democratic way. Still, you know, we're a remarkable legacy in terms of what we have to work with. The third big structural change, the one that was just mentioned in passing, is the important more of the famine. And the reason I do that is because, again, it's kind of, it doesn't feature particularly strongly in Protestant or Ulster history, but the reality is that without the starvation, there's no possibility of an Ulster, no possibility of Northern Ireland. It was until that period, even in the six counties that we have now, there's still a Catholic majority. So the possibility of Protestant majoritarianism only really appears as a consequence of starvation. Not really significant, but again, something that's hardly ever addressed. There's this kind of assumption that there's been more of us than it has been Catholic since the plantation. It's not true. But the really big issue in terms of the history that I want to speak to is this partition itself. And I suppose why that's really important to me is that I think that, despite what I just said about the family majoritarianism, there's something happens to Protestant identity in the context of partition, which is really significant. And it's mostly really reactionary. It kind of moves us from a situation where politically we recognise ourselves as a minority, albeit a relative power, and rather in the context of Northern Ireland, to one where people can begin to imagine a Northern Ireland which has no Catholics at all. So it moves us from a situation where we have to negotiate and envisage and politically in terms of the genocidal imperative, which you can find on any peace line on probably any given wall, loyalist unit, killed, taken, killed, Catholic. It's not an unimportant piece of graffiti. It's a quite frightening, scary indication of the politics. So it's bad for all of us. The notion that it's okay to kill our children, or even write something which invokes that spirit is at the core of some of the issues that I think we need to address in terms of a different narrative of Protestant identity. But it's only possible in the context of Northern majoritarianism. It's only possible in the context where you can imagine that we can live in a polity that has no Catholics at all. And that's what I just wanted to do, because that's so significant actually in terms of a change that I think isn't recognised, and I just wanted to offer a couple of quotes from Unionists writing a petition which puts that in some kind of context. And this is probably the only original research that I did for this paper. I wrote everything else is secondary, but I actually aggregated from the Prodi website the numbers of men and women who signed the covenant and the women who signed the declaration in 1912, and there were 35,393 men and women from Cavan and Donegal and Mullin who were excluded from Ulster, Mount County Ulster as it was, and this is Ben writing at the time. If it is now open to one portion of the province for its own safety to desert the rest, there was never any meaning to the covenant at all. If we were not all to stand by one another, what was the object of the covenant? The facts about the three counties were as clear when the covenant was signed as they are today, and they have not altered. The position of terrible abandoning of people who were not just Irish Protestants, but Ulster Protestants, you know, in a political sense. And they go on to say, remarkable prescience, I have to say, in terms of the way we look at it now. The six counties is too small to be a parliament, and it's bound to become parochial with its 52 members as compared with the 128 for the southern area. Are not nine counties a small enough area for northern parliament? Anyone looking at the map will see what a ridiculous boundary six counties would present. And remember, this is Ulster Protestants writing this. It's Covenant writing this. Donegal cut off with its harbours and rivers and no access to except the six counties. Cavan and Monaghan form a natural boundary to the south of Ulster. Monaghan runs up to a point between Tyrone and Monaghan into the very heart of the province. An argument that's been used is that the three counties contain a majority of nationalists and Sinn Féiners. That is true, but so is Derry City, Fermanagh County, Tyrone County, South Armagh, South Down, and the Falls Division of Belfast, yet no one proposes to exclude them. So, I suppose the point that I'm making about this is that partition did something very brutal to Irish Protestants in a different way to what it did in a brutal fashion to Irish Catholics. And moreover, it was a double partition. It wasn't not just a partitioning of Ireland. So it was kind of cutting off, you know, the Irish churches from the natural and organic Irish identity which they had at that time. But it's also it's cutting off a third of Ulster at the same time. So it really profound the important historical process which completely changes the possibilities of Ulster identity, Ulster Protestant identity in particular, and has consequences obviously for the rest of Ireland. So you find an Irish Protestant identity which is partitioned really dramatically, not once but twice over a short period of time. And people like Carson, whose whole political identity was as Irish Unionists, are left without any frame of reference whatsoever, just attacked, disappears off the political scene, and kind of dies defeated, if you like, because his project was to maintain the position of Irish Unionism, not to partition the conflict. So anyway, to promise to try and keep the speakers in there, so I'll try and speed up slightly. The core point there is that Ulsterness or Ulster Protestant identity is a relatively new phenomenon, something that only really becomes thought of as possible with the Ulster Unionist Convention in 1905. So there's a whole history that if you're Protestant from the north or indeed from the south, you have to connect to, which didn't involve that narrative, which is still there, which is really significant to the questions that I'm raising today. So, to return to that issue of the present, as I said, if you read Susan's book, I think you'd be hard-pushed not to admit that we have some profound problems in terms of the Protestant identity. So I took that as my starting point. I suppose the only thing I would want to say is just to echo what I was saying there about the genocidal imperative. There's something wrong with the culture which burns bonfires with kill all Irish or kill all Cajun. There's something really profoundly wrong and problematic and needing addressing in a culture. I do absolutely acknowledge that it is culture, but it's a culture which is pathological and has really significant negative consequences, not just for Catholics, but for Protestants as well. But to bring that up to date a wee bit, or just to fill it in, the thing that the kind of catalyst for me addressing the question in the book that we referred to really was that routine singing of the Billy Boys and the notion of celebrating their upturn next and Fenian blood. It's kind of quite, I mean, I did it as a child and that was part of what we did when we grew up, but when you think about what that means, to me it's both profoundly challenging. matter what you say about the importance of culture, that the idea that killing off people on the or celebrating the fact that you're up to your neck in somebody's blood, it isn't wrong. It can't be done. I suppose the more recent addition to that has been the stuff around the Chapman of Belfast and this thing, the famine song. It does much the same thing, it's much the same implication, except it's even more interesting for me because it's kind of this mixing of Scottish and Irish references. So whenever Loyalist bands are playing the famine song outside a Catholic church, they know that they're not playing a Scoot Job B, even though it has the same tune. And their Catholic neighbours know that they're not doing it. They know that they're saying, why don't we go home? The family people, why don't we go home? But what makes it even more interesting, screw up, sociologically interesting certainly, is that it's a Scottish song which makes some sense in Scotland. It's saying all the Irish who were famine Irish who are now Celtic supporters and so on can go home before the famine because the famine's over. But in the north of Ireland, it makes absolutely no sense at all. It's really saying, are you singing to your Catholic neighbours who are Indigenous people in Ireland? You should go home. So anyway, it kind of uncovers, or it continues to be evidence, I think, of our continuing unsettlement, if you like. And that's we can address that in discussion, but I don't think that is contestable really. To address some of that stuff and provide a different narrative on. Right, so where does that leave us? Problematic past, an unsettled present, continue need to find some politics which can speak to that. I'm going to say this anyway, but I don't think, despite the differences within unionism, I don't see a narrative within unionism which finds a way of offering politics to Protestants, Catholics, that gets us out of some of that mess. And it's almost like a cheap shot now, but I think the Northern Ireland 21 experience is obviously recent evidence of that. But you have a whole series of promises of liberal unionism from Nihilism to UKNI to Bob McCartney, which for structural reasons, are never able to organise a Protestant vote or Protestant politics in a way that creates a different space from traditional unionism. And then at the same time, you have a traditional unionism which I hadn't reached this position myself many years ago, but if you wanted a confirmation for the emptiness of that of reaction, it was in that recent moment where people were going in, a United Protestant Unionist Front was going in to meet with Theresa Villiers, and you have the whole panoply of unionist voices in that meeting, but at the core of it you have representatives of a party you're associated, according to the PSLI, that was direct racist attacks on black and minority ethnic people in the middle of Belfast. At the point that I'm making about that is at that point I think it would be unthinkable for the Conservatives in choice between what Irishness means and what Ulsterness means, and that's a profound question about empathy as well as a whole. But I think I have, even though I'm a kind of inveterate and unreconstructed student of politics, or somebody who believes that politics is an important thing and a good thing, and something that it's important that more people are involved in, and aren't, you have to recognise that for an awful lot of people, it matters very little, or it doesn't matter at all. So you can't, somebody like me can't force a particular politics down somebody's neck. But what you can suggest is that there's two tiers, if you like, of the project that I think that people should begin to engage with. And the first is a very broad cultural one, which is that whenever you ask any Protestant in Ireland what it means to be Irish, they have, you know, there's a whole panoply of different options in terms of the churches, in terms of sporting organisations, a whole range of identities, some of which are there already, like the obvious example is an Irish rugby team that's supported by everybody but has no immediate implications in terms of the politics of people who the Irish supported or play for it. But anyway, a broad cultural choice about situating ourselves on this island and making sense of what it means to be Irish in a general sense, but more particularly Protestant in Ireland. So that's the first big soft, if you like, non-political project, which already lots of people have begun to do. I mean, the example I drew out in my own writing on that is Van Morrison. I mean, he's to me a quintessentially Irish writer, also quintessentially Protestant in some ways, but somebody who I have no notion of what his politics are. My guess is he probably doesn't take a position on partition or anything like that, but his sense of sense and place is Irish, and that's very significant in terms of what it represents for other Protestants in particular, trying to make sense of who or what they are. So we need some kind of sense of Irish Protestant place, and you know, for me that could start anywhere. It could be Bannistown, it could be Coole, it could be Bowmanstown, it could be Rosin Island. And then, you know, so many people know what those references are about, some of them at all. But I mean, the important thing is that they're all part of an Irish dynamic. They're all part of our sense of Irishness, and they all have a reference in that context. And I suppose just that I should probably say, in terms of Rosin Island, that from my perspective, that I would have thought anybody would prefer a day in the sun in Rosin Island than, you know, standing under a hail of Belfast confetti and said Argyle shops. It's just it's impossible for me to imagine a context in which it's not better to go and have a dander around Rosin Island than, you know, throw stones at people in that past. So there's that side of it. And then there's more a straightforward narrow political choice to mediate around what kind of politics emerge from that. Does it make people unionist? Does it make them Republican? Does it make them nationalist? I don't think it's right to kind of preach to people on that. I don't think it's right to offer people an immediate analysis of what needs to be done on that. But what the key point is still that it's something that is about working out our relationship as Protestants and Protestants to Catholics and the rest of the island, both north and south of the border, and the kind of politics that emerge from that. So that's me at my limit. But I suppose I'll bring it to conclusion by saying that for all the kind of structural, historical processes that I've spoken to, I think at the very heart of the kind of questions that I'm trying to ask is the recognition that it is ultimately an existential choice that people can choose these things. It's not, you're not ethnically driven than any particular politics just because you're Protestant anymore than you are because you're Catholic. So people who make choices about marching, people who make choices about going to church, people who make choices about speaking of faith are all making existential choices, political and cultural choices that they can make. There's nothing that forced me to have the politics that I have, and there's nothing that forces Uncle Andy or in Faithy to do the same. And for all the difficulties that we're in, singing Astral Weeks or the Billy Boys, and that's at one level a silly question, because some people can, you know, I think if you're at a flags protest, probably more people are singing Billy Boys, but they won't necessarily be listening to Billy Boys and the Billy Boys, maybe putting on Astral Weeks and enjoying that. And, you know, when the inaugural East of this East Belfast Festival was there, it was Van Morrison who was headlining that, not a typical band. I think that's significant. And just to, you know, to set up this discussion, I suppose what's really important for me is that for all the stereotyping of Calvinist taciturnity that you get around the Ulster, particularly the Ulster Protestant identity, we produce a lyrical genius like Van Morrison, and that's, there's something really important celebratory in that in itself. And if there's one thing that Ian Paisley and Van Morrison share, it's that common belief in the capacity to be born again, with an evangelical belief, but it's also a mystic visionary one as well. And that, I think that question of the possibility of being born again, maybe that means yourself in an exceptional way, is at the centre of what I'm trying to encourage people.
She'd recognise a lot there. I'm not sure she quite have understood and at first listening the phrase genocide on credit, but she would understand it once she'd explained it, because that of course is at the core of what you're saying, Robbie, that dissenting tradition that, you know, that's all too often left out of a picture about this place, or introduced almost apologetically, let's put it this way, you know, but never centred, never mainstreamed in terms of saying this is who we are, this is what we can be.
If I can just add to that, because it's just that the other, one of the interesting thing about Marianne's book was, if you remember at the start, the title was Leaving in Protestant Chaos, and that a lot of us were going, well, you know, I'm definitely not leaving in Protestant Chaos today, but it's what you make of that.
Well, the story there is, as you know, Mike and I were the publishers of that book, and we had the book ready to go into the shops, printed, bound, everything else, and the title was Further Afield, Moving Away from a Protestant Past. And a couple of the authors objected, so we had to tear the covers off, get the cover renamed, reprinted, reattached, and the title of the book is Journeys from a Protestant Past, which is less problematic. I have one of the original offending editions of Mio Mouse. So look, folks, we've got a little bit of time here. I'll open it up to you to ask questions, make points or whatever. And maybe we'll try this way. Maybe take two or three to start with. If they're really blockbusters of questions, I might think that. But take two or three to start with and see if you can respond.